Do you ever struggle with remembering details from your travels? Then I've got something special for you. How would you like a better way to keep track of all the things you see and experience in Scotland? A way to keep those special memories and all the details fresh for years to come? My new Scotland Travel Journal might just be what you need. It includes daily journaling prompts to help you start writing about your day, lots of space for doodling and notes, prompts to reflect on your trip overall, and suggestions for things to do that help you make more meaningful connections with Scotland. There's also inspiration for your travel bucket list, a map to draw your route, space to keep track of your travel details, and some Gaelic and Scottish phrases to try while you're here. All you have to do is print out the journal, fold the pages in half, and start writing. The Scotland Travel Journal is the perfect companion for your upcoming trip to Scotland. Find it in the Watch Me See online shop or visit the link in the show notes. And now, let's get on with the show. Hello there, and welcome to Wild for Scotland, a podcast full of immersive travel stories from Scotland. I'm your host and storyteller, Cathy Kamleitner. Wild for Scotland helps you connect with Scotland, its people, wildlife, landscapes and histories. In every episode, I either whisk you away on a beautiful adventure or introduce you to inspiring locals and their stories. In between, I share my top tips for your own Scotland trip and how to follow in my footsteps. So lean back and enjoy. Let's travel to Scotland. Today's episode combines two of my favourite things about travelling: adventure and learning. We're heading to the shores of Loch Craignish, a sea loch that is part of the Argyll Hope Spot, an area I told you about last year on season 4. Here in Ardfern, a charity called Sea Wilding is working to restore the biodiversity of the loch for the benefit of wildlife, the planet, and of course also the local community. They do this by restoring two important underwater habitats that we've depleted all over Scotland: seagrass meadows and native oyster beds. In today's episode, you'll hear what both of these are, why they're important, and what the future of the Scottish coasts could look like if Sea Wilding and other similar projects like it are successful. You'll hear from me, as always, taking you along on my adventures, and also from Philip Price, who is one of the locals working for Sea Wilding. I connected with Philip at the start of the year and finally went to meet him back in August on a trip that was partially made possible by the support I get from our Patreon community. If this is your first time listening, hi! Did you know that while you get to listen to Wild for Scotland for free, it actually requires quite a lot of resources to produce the show? Joining our Patreon community is the single most impactful way you can support what we're doing if you enjoy listening to the show, and it costs as little as £3 a month. Here's what our most recent patron, Milan, said to me after signing up. I was just in Scotland for the first time, and I'm already thinking about the next trip back. I didn't discover your work until recently, but it touches the same emotions that your country touched in me. I'm happy to have found the podcast. So if you feel transported to Scotland by our stories and can afford supporting our show for a few quid a month, head to our show notes and find the link to join our Patreon community there. Now, let's get on with the show. This is All That Could Be. I stop paddling and let my paddleboard glide across the surface. Once the ripples of my last stroke have lost their impact, the water is perfectly still. Leaning on my paddle, I look down into a glassy mirror. Although faintly, behind my own reflection, I can start to make out what lies underneath. I strain my eyes to shift focus and see for the first time, very clearly, a meadow. Thick blades of grass are weaving a bright green tapestry covering the ocean floor. I sit down to get a closer look and use my paddle to slow my movement carefully without disturbing the glassy surface too much. I lean over the edge of my paddleboard just enough to get a better view, but not so much that I actually lose my balance. It's low tide and the water is shallow. I guess I could probably reach the ground and stand up quite easily, but I wouldn't want to fall into this microcosm beneath me. It would be a shame to disturb it. An invisible current is slowly carrying me to the edge of the meadow until it gives way to muddy, silty grey. Considerate of the other paddlers around me, I make a big circle to return for a second glance. This time, I slow down earlier, so I can gaze at the miracle beneath my board even longer. The grass is swaying from side to side, moving upwards towards the surface, uncurling its blades and pulling them back in again. It reminds me of visualizing my breath flowing in and out of my body. From up here, that's all I can see. But I know that between the strings of this living, breathing carpet live countless creatures who depend on it for shelter and food. Seagrass meadows are a nursery for all kinds of marine species. The first time I saw a seagrass meadow was during my snorkeling artist residency at the Argyle Hope Spot. We swam across a bay to visit a small patch of seagrass and meet its many inhabitants. I remember seeing brittle stars and snake-lock anemones holding onto the blades of the seagrass itself. Scallops covered the ocean floor and serpulid worms grew on them, stretching their feathery crowns into the current. It was an extraordinary experience to see a seagrass meadow in a marine protected area, so full of life, hidden from plain sight. But unfortunately, many of these meadows have disappeared from our coasts. Surveys of the seabed around Britain can give us an indication of where seagrass meadows could thrive. And based on these surveys, experts believe that we have lost anywhere between 60 and 95% of all our seagrass meadows. And what's left is under constant threat to degrade or disappear. To learn more about this and the efforts to protect and restore Scottish seagrass, I've made my way to Artfarn. The village lies on the shores of Loch Craignish, a sea loch in Argyll between Loch Melford in the north and Loch Sween in the south. It is here that a small community-led rewilding initiative called Sea Wilding has made it their goal to restore the fragments of seagrass left on this stretch of coastline, and hopefully soon expand their efforts even further across Scotland. I'm here for the Wild Seas Weekend, a two-day event where the members of Sea Wilding and several other local organisations share their work with anyone who's passionate about making nature thrive on the west coast of Scotland. The village hall is filled with chatter and posters. I walk from one table to the next, listen to underwater recordings of critters in the loch, look at blades of seagrass under a microscope, and massive examples of fully grown oysters. And I read the murder mystery stories accompanying a collection of seashells. Throughout the weekend, Sea Wilding is hosting sessions in the water too, to take people out to see these hidden treasures for themselves. And that's how I find myself on top of a paddleboard, floating over a seagrass meadow. We continue paddling closer towards the shore. As the water gets even shallower, our guide Eric tells us to sit down on our boards and be careful not to ram our paddles into the ground. He leans forward and reaches down into the water, submerging his arm all the way up to his shoulder. He pulls it back out and holds in his hand something that looks like a rock. It's roundish, flattened on one side and barely the size of his palm. But I know it's not a rock. It's actually a native oyster, and our guide tells us more about it.
And this one's about 2 years old, so we put him down here a couple of years ago, and probably in a year's time he might be big enough to start reproducing, which would be like really exciting. But they're doing quite healthy here. We put several thousand down, so there's quite a few around here, and they do get moved around by the waves, so they kind of spread out over a fairly large area. Generally you see them more often like the cup side down, as kind of maybe the natural way, but they don't seem to mind, not too fussy. We're monitoring these quite closely to see if any like babies ever land on them, because that's the favorite place for juveniles to land. We call them spat, and they like attaching to living oysters and then start creating like a colony of oysters over time. So we're hoping someday these like solitary ones will become big clumps, like you might have seen up in the village hall. There's some like old ones there that on display that have like a nice 3D reef, creating great habitat for like other creatures.
Native oysters are the second species Sea Wilding focuses its effort on, apart from seagrass. What they both have in common is that they don't just thrive for their own sake. Seagrass meadows and native oyster beds actually provide the cornerstones of a thriving ecosystem. Without them, many other species would suffer. And they have, as we lost more and more of our seagrass and oysters. Later that day, I sit down with Philip Price, who works for Sea Wilding, and I ask him to tell me more about this approach of not just restoring a certain species, but really an entire ecosystem.
Yeah. So when you're a person from Homo sapien, we're very good at trying to concentrate on one thing at a time. And unfortunately, ecosystems just don't work like that. And we're only learning that now. So instead of conserving a beetle or conserving a tiger, you've got to think ecosystem level now. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're restoring the seagrass and the oysters, because we believe that's the bedrock of an ecosystem. Rather than saying, right, we want to restore herring or juvenile cod, it's like, well, we're hoping they'll do that themselves once we've built the foundation for where they can have their young and rear their young.
Absolutely. Oh, that makes so much sense. And let's start with seagrass. Why seagrass? What makes seagrass so important, and what role does it play within Scotland?
So seagrass is one of these incredible sort of keystone species, they call it. Basically, just means it's really important for a whole load of other animals to survive and thrive. And why is that? Well, there's a couple of things going on there. So if you can imagine the seabed as this sandy bottom, it's very flat and it doesn't have very much structure. So to enable animals to get shelter or to get food or for things to grow on things, you need structure, particularly in the sea, actually. That's why you always get loads of life around pontoons or boats or whatever. So by planting seagrass, you create this incredible 3D structure in an otherwise sandy-based seabed. But the other thing seagrass does is it draws carbon in from the atmosphere and sequesters it into the sediment. So you've got the bonus of more habitat for loads of different species, including lots of juvenile commercial fish species, and you have this kind of carbon sucking ability as well.
And that's because it photosynthesizes, right? Like a tree up on land, that's what the seagrass does under the water.
So unfortunately, I'm not a scientist. I don't know the exact ins and outs of it, but the general gist, as I understand it, is it's slightly different to a tree. So a tree pulls carbon out of the atmosphere and creates wood, essentially, or grows leaves. There's something goes on with the seagrass that it does that too, but it also feeds the carbon into the sediment through its rhizome structure, which is its root structure. And that means the carbon's locked away. So even if the plant dies, the carbon doesn't get released. So long as you don't go and dredge the seabed, then that carbon stays locked away forever. Well, for as good as ever in terms of a human lifetime. So it's really exciting from that perspective.
And now let's move on to the other species you work with, the native oysters. Yeah. Again, can you explain what they are and why they're so important?
So it's a very similar story there. So the native oyster is a mollusk, essentially a snail with a slightly different shell. And it's very easy to dismiss that as a snail. But actually, And the same with people that study snails. When you get into these animals, they're so fascinating. The fact that this little blobby thing can create a shell that's totally bomb-proof is pretty incredible. But they do the same thing as seagrass. They create structure in an environment that would be lacking structure otherwise. So oysters like to grow in oysters. So if you've got a really healthy reef, what happens is the baby oysters grow in the adult oysters. They become adults. So you've then got two levels. And then the next generation grow in that. So you've got three levels. So you end up having multiple levels of oysters, which allows lots of nooks and crannies and surface area for all sorts of animals to live and exist in. So from that perspective, oysters are incredible. But then they do this other thing that the seagrass doesn't do, is and they filter the water, they clean the water, they take nutrients out of the water and allow the water to be clearer. And actually we find that has a nice benefit for the seagrass, because it lets more light in and hopefully will benefit our seagrass in the future too. Then you think about the world that we live in now compared to the world we could live in. So the world we live in now, we have maybe, I don't know, half a million oysters around the whole country, maybe, I don't know, in little pockets of population. Compare that to 200 or 300 years ago, we would have had billions of oysters literally covering our shorelines. Think about how much of that tank has been cleaned in just a couple of hours. They're doing that to our entire ocean. So the clarity of the water back then must have been phenomenal. And I think that's what drives us forward, is like, imagining this pristine, almost utopian sea that we can have again if we just change a few things and fix a few things.
That's amazing. And it's so inspiring to think it is about that big picture thinking and that future vision, but it is within reach. It's just something that happens in 300 years.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the nice things about the sea particularly. So on land, your timescales for regeneration can be quite long, but we're finding in the sea that you can get a big difference, I think, a little bit quicker. So our seagrass meadows, we think 5 to 10 years, we can see some really big improvements. Even in a year, we've seen a doubling in our biodiversity in our restored seagrass compared to the mud. And the same with the oysters. We're seeing sort of 40 to 50% increase in biodiversity where we've got oysters. And yeah, these are tiny little areas at the moment. But the benefits happen very quickly in the sea because it's an interconnected habitat. So it's properly exciting.
And so in terms of biodiversity, you've already mentioned that there's a vast number of species that find a home in these seagrass meadows, and it's a three-dimensional ecosystem. Can you give us a bit of an insight into what species can you find there? Maybe which ones are common and which ones are the kind of unicorns that if you're really lucky, you can come across?
We'll end on the unicorn, because there is a unicorn. There's literally a unicorn, as we'll come to. So in terms of your commercial value, let's say, the argument we're making to the government to fund this is you have to kind of make, we shouldn't have to be honest, but we do have to make a kind of commercial argument as to why we need to restore this stuff. And that's because it's really good for juvenile commercial fish species. So we find juvenile cod in the seagrass. We find juvenile herring in the seagrass. We find a lot of juvenile sand eels in the seagrass. And these are really important fish species for the whole ecosystem. And if you eat fish, which I don't, but if you did, they're important for food source as well. So we find that in the seagrass. Where you were snorkeling today is a smaller patch, and we've seen juvenile cod and herring in there, but with a big group like we had today, they'd have gone and hidden away. So the species that we find that are a bit bolder, we've got juvenile pollock. They like the seagrass, really love it actually. A wonderful little fish called a stickleback. They're quite common, but just very beautiful. And then one of my favourites is a species of fish called gobies. There's lots of different types, so I never know which one we're looking at. But they're just very cute, and they're not that scared of people, so they'll just hang around while you're swimming through them, and they just sort of look at you, and you look at them, and they swim in the tops of the seagrass. So that's wonderful. They're the sort of main fish species we see. And then if you go down into the seagrass a bit more, you get things like peacock worms, which are kind of like the flowers of the seagrass meadow. They're not the flower of the seagrass meadow. They're a worm, but they look like flowers. And then you get a beautiful thing called a snake lock anemone, which is a kind of squidgy thing when it's out of the water. But in the water, again, it's got a very flower-like property. It can go purple and greens, and it's absolutely stunning. So there's some more of the kind of mollusky worm species that you might see in the actual seagrass. We've found clams in the seagrass, scallops, dogfish-like seagrass. But the slightly rarer ones to see is a wonderful animal called a pipefish, which is proper amazing. And they're related to the unicorn. So if we ever find one of these, and my kids are convinced they've seen them, but I think they're lying, is a seahorse. So seahorses love seagrass, and that is the one to find. If we find that, whew, yeah, we'd be pretty happy.
We went snorkeling in the seagrass meadows last year.
The next morning, I find myself standing at the car park in front of the village hall again. I've already put on the bottom half of my wetsuit, but the neoprene arms are still dangling from my hips. There are about 10 others, all in various stages of wrapping their body in neoprene. Some of them are local, others have travelled, like me, from further afield. But everyone is equally excited to get in the water. After a quick safety briefing, we cross the road and climb down the steps towards the shore. One after the other, we put on our goggles and snorkels and walk into the sea. As soon as the water is deep enough, I crouch down and put myself vertically, floating on the surface. At first, the water is cold, especially around the goggles on my face. But after a few breaths, my skin acclimatizes, and I forget all about the temperature. I look up to spot our snorkel guide and follow his lead towards a number of small dinghies moored in the shallows. I swim slowly until the edge of the meadow comes into view. It starts with just a few bunches of seagrass that turn into patches until the gaps between them disappear and the entire seafloor is covered in green. Although seagrass isn't green like a meadow above the surface, instead, it's the colour of young birch leaves sprouting in spring, mixed with shades of blue and grey. In Scottish Gaelic, the boundary between blue and green, gorm and uainne, is blurry. This meadow would certainly be called gorm, blue, and I can see why. I swim through the green-blue haze, focusing my gaze forwards and down to detect any signs of life among the plants. As I swim through the meadow, tiny bubbles of air rise towards the surface, making the water not murky, but also not entirely clear. This isn't a sterile environment. Instead, life seems to be taking up every cubic millimetre. Sometimes, the water is high enough for me to fly over the meadow and get a bird's eye view. Then again, I move closer to the shore and can feel the blades of seagrass brushing up against my body and face. It's disorienting, to say the least, but I'm mindful that I can't just stand up to see where exactly I am. Too precious is the ecosystem beneath me. Instead, I try to remember where I saw the dinghies on the surface and follow the ropes holding their moorings to deeper waters. Although not much is visible of these ropes, they're covered in sea squirts whose bulging bodies are white and yellow. Between them are bunches of seaweed, some growing on the ropes, others discarded and caught by the current. I float past tiny crustaceans and delicate anemones, rarely bigger than the nail on my pinky. I come across a small shoal of gobies, and like Philip had told me, they hover for a while, inspecting me closer and waiting for me to make my next move, before in an instant disappearing into the thicket of the undergrowth. I spot a common prawn, even though it would deserve a much more dazzling name. Its body is almost entirely translucent, were it not for the delicate red lines and bright yellow knuckles. I look up again and see that the first people are already out of the water again. My time in the meadow is running out. And then I see it. An elongated fish with a dark, fan-shaped dorsal fin. Two fins at the top and the bottom, set quite far back on its body. A pointy snout and a black stripe across the side of its body. It's yellow, with white spots, and unlike the gobies who made a sudden departure, it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. On the contrary, it turns its body and swims around me, dipping sometimes deeper into the seagrass and other times coming straight at me. I try not to move, make myself as unintimidating as possible, and like the goby, hover for a while. After a minute or so, I rip myself loose and bid the fish farewell. Sea sticklebacks might be common, as Philip said. They are nonetheless mesmerising creatures to encounter on my journey into the seagrass. Back on land, I peel out of my wetsuit and wrap up in my dry robe. Cradling a cup of tea from the village hall, I think back to that picture of a utopian sea Philip mentioned yesterday. And I feel like I just saw a glimpse of what's possible. All that could be if only we had more seagrass and native oyster beds along our coasts, and all the life that comes with them. I'm going to give Philip the last word. I asked him to paint me another picture of what the future might look like and what gives him hope that we'll be able to get there.
So bigger picture stuff. We have this climate crisis. We have this biodiversity crisis. And on one hand, you could think, oh, no, you know, we're maybe looking at human extinction if we don't sort this out. But the other hand is, if we do sort this out, what is it going to look like? It's going to look incredible. We're going to have very low cost energy. We're going to have beautiful air quality. We're going to have abundant wildlife. We're going to have farming systems that work with nature for people and for wildlife. This is a utopian vision. And it's not like we could have it. We have to have it to survive. And actually, for some reason, that gives me huge amounts of hope, because we're either not going to succeed and go extinct, or we're going to succeed and have this incredible world that we're going to have forged for our generation, possibly, but definitely for the future generations. So in terms of, are we going to be a good ancestor for them? Then we have to be. And if we achieve that, then we'll be a brilliant ancestor for future generations. So it's going to be super exciting. So bigger picture stuff, that gives me real hope. On the local level, I've got real hope too, because we did a survey recently and it turned out the vast majority of the local population care about their loch and wanted to see it better. Wanted to see it healthier. And that's enabled us to go down this DNR MPA that we were talking about earlier, the research marine protected area. So that's a game changer. People didn't have that care years ago. You know, they're either too hard at work just surviving, or it just wasn't in their sphere of knowledge or thinking or whatever it was. And then you go and swim in seagrass and you're like, imagine there being more of this stuff. It's so awesome. And then you watch those oysters clean that tank out and you're like, the sea could be like this. You know what I mean? So if we can achieve even half of what we need to, the world's going to be a very wonderful place. So yeah, definitely full of hope. So I'll give you another wee analogy you might find quite useful. Is that we're doing these interviews with people about what the loch used to be like. And the amount of life in here is just used to be phenomenal. And there's a wildlife boat trip that would go out of Crewe Haven, which is just over the other side of the peninsula. And he would go out of here and he had to go at 5 knots because there were so many seabirds around his boat. He would have killed them if he didn't go that slowly. Just hundreds, thousands, as far as the eye could see. They don't exist now. They've gone. There's no food for them. So yeah, what does it look like in the future? Well, I go out my boat, I can't go 5 knots because I'm going to crush these millions of seabirds. And then there's pods of dolphins, there's huge populations of orcas, there's great whales back on our shoreline, and there's flapper skate the size of 3 metre wingspans flying around the loch. That's what the future looks like.
I hope you enjoyed this trip to Loch Craignish and my conversation with Philip Price from Sea Wilding. To learn more about their work and seagrass restoration, check out the full show notes on our website, where you'll find links to additional resources, pictures and videos from my trip, and of course the full transcript of today's episode. In this week's newsletter, I'll tell you more about my trip to Artfern, including my favourite swim spot, my biggest regret when I went snorkelling one last time before leaving, and what else you can do in the area. You can sign up via the link in the show notes. Now, it's time for the practical part of the show, Here are five travel tips to get the most out of your own journey to Scotland's seagrass meadows and beautiful Loch Craignish. Tip number one, get involved with sea wilding. Seagrass is not necessarily at the top of people's minds when it comes to marine conservation, and not everybody has the opportunity to experience it firsthand. But organisations like Sea Wilding highlight the importance of these coastal habitats, and they create opportunities for people to engage with them. The Wild Seas Weekend was one of them. But Sea Wilding also runs regular volunteer opportunities and other ways to get involved. You can follow them on Instagram at seawilding for pictures and videos, and check out their website seawilding.org for upcoming events and opportunities. If volunteering is not in the cards for you, you can also make a donation to support their ongoing efforts. Tip number two, book a guided snorkel tour. If you're visiting Artfarn and would like to see the seagrass meadow in Loch Craignish up close, consider booking a snorkel experience with an experienced guide. There are now more and more wild swimming guides in Argyll, and one of my favourites is of course Dan the Merman, who you met earlier this season. He will keep you safe in the water and help you understand the marine landscape through a Gaelic lens. Tip number three, stay at the Artfarn Motorhome Park. During my time at the Wild Seas Weekend, I was invited to stay at the Artfarn Motorhome Park, a small rustic site with 12 pitches, eco-friendly toilet facilities, and stunning views of Loch Craignish. The park is located in a tranquil setting on the loch, but just a 15-minute walk from the village. I wish I could have stayed much longer. Tip number four, eat at Lucy's in Artfarn. Lucy's is a wonderful addition to the food scene in Argyll. The cafe offers delicious homemade food and baked goods for breakfast and lunch. Their vegan cinnamon rolls are my absolute favourite item on their menu. Tip number five, explore other places on the North Argyll Snorkel Trail. The seagrass meadows across the road from the Craignish Village Hall is one of many sites on the North Argyll Snorkel Trail, which was developed by the Scottish Wildlife Trust and the Argyll and the Isles Tourism Cooperative. Some other nearby sites for snorkelling are the Jetty and the Bay near Loch Melfort Hotel, and the beaches Ganavan Sands and Wee Ganavan near Oban. And here's an extra tip for you. If you like listening to stories about local communities and their strategies to counteract the climate crisis, check out the podcast 1000 Better Stories. This week, they're airing my full interview with Philip Price, in which we talk about what it means to run a community-led charity, how seagrass restoration actually works, and what challenges they face as a small charity on the Scottish West Coast. So keep your eyes and ears peeled for it. And with this, I send you off to dream about your own trip to Artfarn and the shallow waters of beautiful Loch Craignish. I hope this episode has inspired you to look below the surface and learn about the dazzling underwater world at your doorstep, whether that's in Scotland or further afield. Next week, we're swapping the shallow seas for a rumbling river. Instead of a paddleboard and snorkel, I'll be taking you out in a canoe to meet one of Scotland's most elusive inhabitants. I hope you'll tune in again. Thank you so much for listening to Wild for Scotland. Wild for Scotland is part of the Tremula Network, adventure and outdoor podcasts off the beaten path. The show is written and hosted by me, Kathy Kamleitner, thanks to Fran Turowskis, who's the co-producer and editor and does the sound design. Michelle Payne and Anesu Matanda Mambingo are supporting us with social media and transcripts. Podcast art is by Lizzie Vaughan Knight, and all original music is composed by Bruce Wallace. Until next time, when we travel to a different watery place in Scotland. If you're still here, listening all the way to the very end, it means you've probably got your hands full. So let me take this opportunity to remind you that I don't just write immersive travel stories. I also plan unforgettable itineraries for Scotland, and it's never been easier to follow one of my routes. Head to watchmesee.com/shop to browse my ready-made Scotland itineraries and turn your travel dreams into reality.